This book called Shriyash Upanishad is Hare Krishna. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
This Shriyash Upanishad is very special. It's from the original Vedas, which are millions of years old. And it's got Sanskrit mantras in it. You'll find it under the pink tab. It's all color-coded. Hare Krishna. Isha, or Isho, means the controller and owner of everything. And by reciting this mantra, all our problems are solved, because our primary problem is misidentifying who owns everything. And when I misunderstand and I think that I own everything, then I take a great burden on my head, because as soon as I identify with something, I have to take it on, and I have to try to control it, and I can't control it. There's only a small field of activities that we actually have a little bit of control over. So Ishopanishad is a treatise which explains who's actually the owner and controller of everything. And just that information and knowledge and orientation in and of itself brings relief, knowing who the owner and controller is. So we'll read the English translations all the way through to get a sense for the Shriyash Upanishad. And let's read them together. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is a complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. Everything animate or inanimate that is within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota, and one should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. One may aspire to live for hundreds of years if he continuously goes on working in that way, for that sort of work will not bind him to the law of karma. There's no alternative to this way for man. The killer of the soul, whoever he may be, must enter into the planets known as the worlds of the faithless, full of darkness and ignorance. Although fixed in his abode, the personality of God, it is swifter than the mind, and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place, he controls those who supply the air and rain, he surpasses all in excellence. The Supreme Lord walks and does not walk. He is far away, but he is very near as well. He is within everything, and yet he is outside of everything. He who sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being. One who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? Such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial. Mantra 9. Those who engage everyone together in the culture of nascent activities shall enter into the darkest region of ignorance. Worse still are those engaged in the culture of so-called knowledge. The wise have explained that one result is derived from the culture of knowledge and that a different result is obtained from the culture of nascence. Only one who can learn the process of nascence and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. Those who are engaged in the worship of demigods enter to the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so to the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and another result is obtained by worshipping what is not supreme. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it. Once you know perfectly the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it. And in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. O my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. O my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun, as am I. Let this temporary body be burned to ashes, and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I have done for you. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, O omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you, and since you know all I've done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins so that there'll be no hindrance to my progress. This is the Sri Ishapanishad. And I'll just point out that each one of these verses are mantras. By meditating on them, we can free ourselves from the mist and clouds of ignorance and anartas. Essentially, what we're practicing, bhakti yoga, is also called Purushottam Yoga, which is explained in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And Purushottam Yoga, Purusha means a person, and Uttama means the supreme. So this is called, in translated or unpacked from the Sanskrit, the yoga of the supreme person. And yoga comes from the word yuj, which means to connect. Bhakti is based on the word bhaj, which is something like sharing or having communion or giving. So this kind of yoga is dependent on a personal relationship. And that's what's expressed throughout the Sri Ishapanishad. In the very first verse, we understand that the source of everything and the owner of everything, well, at least in the first verse, the source is described, and he's a person. He's personal. And that makes all the difference in the world, actually. When we find out that there's a person behind something, then our consciousness changes, doesn't it? Like, if we go through this temple and we, if say, like, you turn on the light and you turn on the heat throughout the month and you really don't think about it much, what happens at the end of the month? We'll get a bill, and somebody will say, you know, pay up. You used electricity. We're using it right now. And they'll ask for their money. And who's asking for it? It's not just a computer-generated letter. It doesn't happen. If you follow it back far enough, you're going to find out that there's somebody in an office, and they're a person. And you can actually talk to them. You could actually go there. If we gave someone the project in this room to figure out who's behind generating that bill, who's responsible for it, who's making us pay, you could probably find out. Right, Pooja? How would you do that? I'd Google it if I was you. Yeah, you could ask somebody, and there's 6 degrees of separation. You can go across the country and find people fairly easily by connecting one to the next to the next. But the point is, if you go back, you'll find out who's behind the light department. There's a man or a woman back there who's in control of it, and they have a head, and they have eyes, and they have a mouth, and a tongue, and ears, and they walk around. And they have their own opinion about life and volition, and they have a personality. So if you follow that back, everything in creation, aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. Krishna makes a profound statement in the Bhagavad Gita. Well, they're all profound statements, but here's one of them. And that is that if you understand, if you follow it back and understand how I'm the source of everything, including I'm the source of the person who asked you to pay your electric bill and everybody else and everything else, then your life will change, and you'll have gratitude towards me, and you'll give everything to me, and you'll have love for me. This is the result of that. So the very problem of existence is ignorance, and ignorance means ignorance. It means ignoring what our source is, where everything's coming from, who's supplying us. And the simple process of Purushottam Yoga is to meditate on the person, actually, who's bringing us everything. And when that sense of personality comes into my purview, then it evokes a kind of gratitude, kind of love. And that's what real yoga is meant to do. We connect through love and appreciation. And we want to give something back. This is Purushottam Yoga. And Sri Upanishad, verse by verse, gives us this reassurance and this idea, starting with the very first verse of the Upanishad, the invocation, that the personality of God, it is perfect and complete, and that everything that emanates from him is perfectly complete, and that even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. He's not diminished by the fact that unlimited energies come from it. And this is another very reassuring fact, and that is that God's potencies and energies are unlimited. And the Upanishad goes on to explain this even more. Tadejati, tadnaijati, tadure, tadvantike, tarantarasya sarvasya, taru sarvasya sibayata. The Supreme Lord walks and he does not walk. He's far away, but he's very near as well. He's within everything, and yet he's outside of everything. These are seemingly contradictory statements, but they're meant to express to us the inconceivable potency of Krishna, that he can be everywhere at the same time. He can expand himself into all these energies and at the same time maintain his divine personality. And he's all attractive. As Acharya Chandraprabhu was pointing out to me earlier, that Krishna's beautiful. That's why we're attracted to him. If he was ugly, we wouldn't be so attracted. Just like you said, Arjuna, when he saw the universal form, it was ghastly. There were many ghastly forms. And he said, show me your other form. I want to see Somyavapu. I want to see the beautiful form. And so Krishna, from his inconceivable, he's the infinite. I'm infinitesimal. But if the infinite wants to reveal himself to the infinitesimal, he can do so. He has that power to do that. And therefore, it's altogether possible to see Krishna. And later on in the Upanishad, Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasapita Mukham, the devotee asks, please, I want to see your personal features, because Krishna also has an effulgence, the Brahman effulgence, which is covers his personal features. But when one becomes a devotee of Krishna, then he can remove that covering and show himself. Just as when someone becomes your friend and you trust them very much, then you'll remove your effulgence or whatever else is covering you, and you can reveal yourself to that person. You'll give him all your secrets. It doesn't happen easily, does it? Do you have many friends that you tell everything to? Do you have any that you tell every single thing to? Does anybody? You have somebody, and you tell them everything, right? But you have to really trust them first, don't you? So Krishna says the same thing in the Bhagavad Gita, that to Arjuna, he said, you're not envious of me, and you're my dear friend. And he calls them all kinds of friendly names, and therefore I'm telling you all these things. And it's a great benefit to us, too, because I just happened to be speaking publicly at the same time. It got all recorded when he was speaking to Arjuna. So it's kind of like we're eavesdropping on a personal conversation. It's like if you were revealing all your secrets to your best friend, whoever that might be, we won't ask. But, you know, and we just happened to, cut in on the same line, but you didn't hear us, and we're listening, you were telling everything. Then we'd know all about you, you know, what you really thought, right? And this is the same thing. Krishna's telling Arjuna, and everyone can listen in, like, that's what he really thinks. he says some amazing things. Api chet suraracharo bhajate mamananya pak sadureva samantavya samyag vyavasito hisaha. In the ninth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he begins talking about his devotees. And he said, I don't care what they do. Whatever they do, it doesn't matter to me because they're so dear to me. You have to consider them to be sadhus. This is Krishna's heart coming out for the devotees. Even if they're sudarachara, that means like the worst kind of character. If they're devoted to me, they're sadhus. They're perfect. And they'll be protected by me. And they'll attain perfection. Shri pram pavati dharmatma shashvach chantim nagachati. Kontiya prachijanihi nami bhakti pranashiti. My devotee will never be vanquished. So it's very encouraging, actually. And it changes the... it changes our perspective and the way we do business. Because... if Krishna owns everything and he's the supplier of everything, then what anxiety is there? What anxiety do we need to have if I'm devotee's, Krishna's devotee? There's no necessity for any kind of anxiety. Right? Okay. I promised I was going to talk about weakness of heart. And before I, the time sneaks away, and I miss talking about that, I want to talk about this idea of weakness of heart. Where in the Bhagavad Gita does it first come up about weakness of heart?
Chapter 2,
very good. And can you cite the verse? Pooja, can you hand her a microphone and grab the other one also?
Hare Krishna. Kutasva kashmalam idam vishamya samupastidam anarajishtam asvargyam akirtikaram arjuna shutram hirdar darbalyam taktutthashti parantapa.
Bravo. That's a hridaya durbalya. That means weakness of heart. So hridaya means the heart, right? And durbalya means a weakness. So in the very beginning, before Krishna speaks to Arjuna, Arjuna reveals that he has a weakness of heart. And in the 15th chapter, what inspired me to talk about weakness of heart are two things. One is that the last verse of the 15th chapter, in the last paragraph of the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that there are weaknesses of heart that one must give up in order to advance in spiritual life. And he says that the first five verses of the 15th chapter are about how to give up weakness of heart, right? And there's a little more explanation about what the categories of weakness of heart are in the Harinam Chintamani. And so, first of all, let's define what weakness of heart is, and then we'll try to see it. We'll talk about how it might linger within our own hearts. And then we'll talk about ways that it can be rectified. Is that fair enough? So far, so good? Okay. So here are the definitions, or the symptoms, the elements of weakness of heart listed by Haridas Thakur in the Harinam Chintamani. Number one is attachment to trifling things unrelated to Krishna. What does trifling mean? What's a trifle?
Insignificant.
Yeah. Insignificant. Small. Not important. Right? So attachment to trifling things unrelated to Krishna. And it's described in the Sanskrit, asat trishna, or a thirst for things that are asat. They're temporary. They're not significant. They're not lasting value. Second is deceit. What does deceit mean?
Cheat.
Huh?
Cheat.
Yes. Deceit means a kind of a cheating mentality. And, the propensity to cheat. So that's a kind of weakness of heart. Three, envy of someone else's progress. Envy of someone else's progress. Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaks about this in the bhajan he wrote about humility. And he was expressing in that bhajan the mentality of someone who's has bad qualities. And he says that when I see someone else fail, I become very happy. And when someone else becomes successful at it, I become very morose. So this is a kind of weakness of heart, to have envy that someone else is making progress. Yes? Got to turn that up all the way.
When you mentioned about someone else's progress, is that in the material plane or a spiritual plane, or both?
Either way. It's a feeling for, you know, when you see someone else doing well, that you feel bad about it. Huh?
Not bad,
miserable. Miserable. You become miserable when you see someone else happy or successful or moving ahead. And like that. Okay, and the fourth is a longing for position and fame. A longing for position and fame. Attachment to trifling things unrelated to Krishna, deceit, envy of someone else's progress, and a longing for position and fame. So, let's just talk for a few minutes about, if you care to, about where you see any of these. Have you ever experienced any of these elements? Or are there other categories or things that about weakness of heart? Prabhupada describes weakness of heart in this last verse of the 15th chapter as becoming attracted to matter, and then becoming more and more attached to it, these two things. And do you have any comments about weakness of heart, just in general? What it feels like if you've ever experienced it?
Hare yes. Krishna, Prabhuji. It really feels painful, but if we see that, these are the main pillars of success in non-Krishna conscious activities.
I see.
So if these things are not there, there is no impetus, then people consider that we are not ambitious, then practically we are useless without if we don't have all this. So.
Mm. Yes.
I can add that if people would not have envy of someone else's progress, there wouldn't be any progress at all in the world, because they just see someone doing well and they see no, they think, huh. I have to do better.
Oh, very interesting.
I have to design a new software better than this one.
Yeah, I saw a high-rise building in Taiwan, in Taipei, and it's the second largest building in the world. It really sticks up. Actually, I think it looks pretty odd because it's so tall amidst so many smaller buildings. It just really sticks up into the air. And it's the second largest because it was the first largest, and then someone had to build one a little bit larger. And this has been going on for a long time. Empire State Building used to be the largest building in the world. And then somebody else challenged, and they had to design it. When they designed it specifically, they had to put a few extra, even the flagpole. It's like, okay, 2 inches bigger, we got it, you know. Yeah, so, and someone make a product. We have a saying in America that to keep up with the Joneses, it means the Joneses are supposed to be like the Patels, you know, next door. A common name, Jones. So you see the neighbors, and then, you know, they got a new lawn, so we have to get a new lawn to keep up with the Joneses. That kind of idea. So. Any other thoughts about weakness of heart? Yes.
I have a question. In this text, Karpanya Dosha Pahatasva Bhavaha, Arjuna is talking about his weakness. Is it this falls in this one of these four categories, this weakness, or something different?
Yeah, it's described Klaibhyamma Samagama Partha Naita Tva Upapadyate, that he's expressing that he has a weakness of heart, that he can't do his duty. He knows what his duty is, but he can't do it. And it's because it's caused by the same kind of weakness of heart that causes other kinds of material affliction, which is bodily identification. Comes back to that. So yes, it's the same. And it is the reason that he's hesitating in the very beginning. It's because of this weakness of heart. And that's pointed out right from the very beginning. Any other thoughts? It's good to talk about it. What's the weakness of heart? Hare Krishna. Okay, so just keep open channels and we'll keep going. Yes.
One more question. Yes. This four types of weaknesses, is that categorizing all the weaknesses possible, or there are some other weaknesses might be possible not mentioned and here this?
These are general categories, but there can be all kinds of subcategories, like attachment to trifling things unrelated to Krishna. You could expand that into many different areas. You know, trifling things on the bodily platform, the subtle platform. Deceit comes in all different kinds, ways and shapes, and things like that. I don't think it's an exhaustive list, but it's representative of
major
categories, yeah. And it's personally, when I hear the list, I feel empowered because, and I'll tell you why. Were you about to say something?
I was going to ask you, why does it say trifling things? I mean, I would think anything not related to Krishna, attachment to anything not related to Krishna.
It's emphasizing the fact that there are things which are not important. Please forgive me if anybody's an avid golfer, but golf is, in a way, is a trifle. People spend a lot of time and money to play golf, and basically, I mean, if you analyze it, it's hitting a ball into a hole. And so it's considered a trifle compared to the purpose of a human form of life, which is to inquire, and which we have very little time to do. So it's emphasized that it's trifling because there are things that are insignificant. I may have missed the subtlety of your question. Did I? Try again.
No, I was just asking, like, why attachment to anything unrelated to Krishna would be a weakness of heart. Was he trying to emphasize that even if you're attached to trifling things, it is bad?
Yeah, anything unrelated to Krishna.
Krishna.
But there's a catching point to this, because ultimately nothing's unrelated to Krishna. And that's, we're getting to that part of the solution to this idea of being related, of, you know, being absorbed in things. But there are things which are, we could consider trifling, that they're insignificant. They're anartas, or they're false values, because they don't assist us in our spiritual life, so we should give them up. And they're considered trifling, in that they're insignificant. We can spend a lot of times on little things that they're considered trifling because they're not. We don't see their relationship to Krishna. But I understand your point, because I thought the same thing when I was writing this. I thought you could take out trifling because anything unrelated to Krishna. But it adds a little flavor to it, because I like the word trifling, because so much of what goes on. I mean, I had this thought when I was on the airplane flying to Tokyo, and it's a long flight. Actually, it's going to Osaka. It's 12 hours, and they go. First of all, they try to appease the senses of the passengers, because it's actually boring when you sit in a fuselage for that long. The senses become a little bit eager to see some variety and things like that. So they bring by these carts with drinks on them. And I was thinking, here's representation of the best that's to offer here in the material world. And there's like three kinds of drinks, Coca-Cola, Sprite, you know, your two representatives, dark, light, and then they have some juice, and orange juice, and maybe, you know, some coffee or something like that. But maybe three, four, five different kinds of things. And none of them are very exciting at all. And I was imagining that that what they were offering from that cart was the best of what's available in the material world. And it's all trifling stuff. I mean, Coca-Cola is sugar water with a little flavor. It doesn't even taste good, in my opinion. I don't like that either. I always wondered when I was a kid, what's in this stuff? It tastes terrible. Why do you drink it? And it's trifling. I mean, people smoke cigarettes, but I remember as kids, I saw friends try to, you know, learn how to smoke cigarettes, and it took them a while because it tastes terrible. They're you know, and after a while, they learn how to do it. It's a trifling matter. It's insignificant. It's not helpful. It's an anarta. But you learn how to do it and become attached to it. This is due to weakness of heart, becoming attached to trifling things. They're not related to Krishna. They're not helpful in us advancing in spiritual life. So why is it important, or why does it give us some kind of advantage to identify what these things are or where they are? Do you want to talk about that for a minute? Let's talk about it. So we're identifying, let's say we're identifying the enemy that's blocking us, or the obstacle. Now we know what the obstacle is. We know what the goal is. We want to move forward towards loving Krishna. And what's holding me back? Now if you have it, well, let me stop and I'll ask you. You have a microphone, please. You have some thoughts about why it's important to identify, or how does it make you feel to identify these categories of weakness of heart? Your reaction to hearing them, if any. If you don't, we'll move on. It's okay.
I would say that every person has his own troubles in spiritual life, and troubles for one person will not be troubles for another person, but another troubles will be troubles for him, right? So if each and other person will identify his own weaknesses of heart, it will be not generalized science but personal science for him, and it will help him personally to fight these weaknesses.
Very well put. Thank you.
Another point that came to my mind was, Prabhuji, suppose if we are diseased and if doctors could not locate what it is, it may take a very long time to understand what it is. So now we are so fortunate because our experienced souls through the Shastras are giving us that these are the main points and where we have to attack, yes, so that we can get cured.
This is both are very nice points. This is practical. Probably everyone's had an experience of going to a doctor when they feel ill, and then the doctor says, "I have no idea. I can't help you." Right? How frustrating is that? Ramananda, is that camera working or no?
No, it's not working.
We're not working. So nothing's being recorded, right? Okay. Don't mind, but I need to record this. Go to the doctor, and he can't tell you what's wrong with you. It's very frustrating. I've known people like this. They go to doctor after doctor. They fly around the world, and no one can tell them. And as soon as they meet a doctor who says, "Oh, I know what this is. You know, all you need is some, you know, buttermilk." And why didn't they tell you before? And they immediately feel hope in life, even if he's wrong. So, and when we're correctly diagnosed and we have an idea of exactly what it is, then we can start addressing the problem. And I mean, being sick is really bad when you don't know how to cure it and when you don't see any end to it. So here, this weakness of heart is a kind of it's a disease. It's a heart disease. It's a spiritually weakened or sick position. So we want to identify what that is. You had another comment?
Just going to comment on it from a different perspective. Like, these are your enemies and you have to fight them, and it's, if you have to fight somebody, you have to know about them. And as you know, even Duryodhan did that in the
even
battle.
What
even Duryodhan did that in the battle of Mahabharata. As soon as you know, as soon as the first chapter of Gita opens up, he's the first thing that he does is he drishtva tu panduvanikam. He looks at the army and then he goes to his guru and starts pointing out, like, here's that, you know, look at, there's Bhim and there's this and there's that. They're all very powerful, so we need to know who our enemies are before we can start to fight
nice.
them.
Yes.
Prabhuji, I was wondering, like, why the attachment to the family and friends is not mentioned as one of the weaknesses of heart, or is that covered in the first thing, attachment to trifling things are related to Krishna?
Yes. Now, look in your Bhagavad Gita on Chapter 3, text number 40 and 41. We're going to read these two. Because here, Arjuna is asked Krishna about lust. And Krishna is explaining where to find it and how to alleviate it. We could argue, probably successfully, that this weakness of heart and lust are related. Krishna describes lust as the eternal enemy of the soul. And so, text number 40 is on page 186. Indriyani mano bhudhir asyadhishtanam uchite etar vimohayat yesha gyanam avrita dehinam. The senses, the mind, and the intelligence are the sitting places of this lust. What are the sitting places of lust? The senses, the mind, and the intelligence are the sitting places of lust. They sit in those places. So they can sit actually in the senses and in the mind and in the intelligence. Lust can sit there. Through them, lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders him. What covers the real knowledge of the living entity? Lust. Yes, so purport. The enemy has captured different strategic positions in the body of the conditioned soul. And therefore, Lord Krishna is giving hints of those places so that one who wants to conquer the enemy may know where he can be found. Mind is the center of all activities of the senses. And thus, when we hear about sense objects, the mind generally becomes a reservoir of all ideas. Hare Krishna. Of sense gratification. And as a result, the mind and the senses become the repositories of lust. Next, the intelligence department becomes the capital of such lustful propensities. Intelligence is the immediate next-door neighbor of the spirit soul. Lusty intelligence influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego and identify itself with matter, and thus the mind and senses. And thus, with the mind and senses, the spirit soul becomes addicted to enjoying the material senses and mistakes this as true happiness. This false identification of the spirit soul is very nicely explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.84.13. Yasyatma bhuti kunapetri dhatuke swati kalatradishu bhoma ichadi yatirta bhuti salilena karichit janishu abhikeshu sa eva kokra. A human being who identifies this body made of three elements with the self, who considers the byproduct of the body to be his kinsman, and who considers the land of birth worshipable, and who goes to the place of pilgrimage simply to take bath rather than to meet men of transcendental knowledge there, is to be considered like an ass or a cow. So here, Krishna, and then Prabhupada's following up, is giving a sort of a military example, like we're fighting an enemy, and the enemy has captured different strategic points. So we're in a battle, right? We actually have to fight. And Krishna recommends this at the end of this chapter. He says, stand and fight. Be like a warrior, stand and fight. And not just, he's not talking about the battlefield there also, but you fight inwardly. This cause of blocking our spiritual progress and our knowledge, which is the lust, and it's situated in the senses, in the mind, and the intelligence, strategic points. And when it gets the intelligence becomes lusty. The intelligence can do so many things. It can invent so many different things. But what are they all for? They become instruments of that lust. And this is the meaning of the word duskriti. There's sukriti and there's duskriti. So kriti means that actually you're expert at something. You can do something well. Duskriti means you can do something that's really bad, but you do it really well. People go to jail and then they learn how to do more bad things. Like, once they're in jail, everyone teaches them, oh, no, and let me show you how to do a real forgery, Let me show you. You want to pick a lock? Here, come over to my cell, I'll show you how to pick a lock. And they become really great duskritis. So when the intelligence is affected by lust, then the centers for education, everyone's figuring out ways to do bad things, bad for the soul, bad for our progress in spiritual life. And next verse, Krishna gives the solution. Here's the solution, how to defeat the enemy. We all want to know this, right? Tasmat tvam indriyan yadhau niyamya bharatarshaba papmanam prajahihyenam jnana vijnana nashanam. Therefore, O Arjuna, best of the Bharatas, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses, and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. Purport, the Lord advised Arjuna to regulate the senses from the very beginning so that he could curb the greatest sinful enemy, lust, which destroys the urge for self-realization and specific knowledge of the self. Jnana refers to knowledge of self as distinguished from non-self, or in other words, knowledge that the spirit soul is not the body. Vijnana refers to specific knowledge of the spirit soul's constitutional position and his relationship to the supreme soul. It is explained thus in the Srimad Bhagavatam 2.9.31. Jnanam paramakuhyam me yad vijnana samanvitam sa rahasyam tat angam cha grahana gaditam maya. The knowledge of the self and supreme self is very confidential and mysterious, but such knowledge and specific realization can be understood if explained with their various aspects by the Lord Himself. Bhagavad Gita gives us that general and specific knowledge of the self. The living entities are parts and parcels of the Lord, and therefore they are simply meant to serve the Lord. This consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. So from the very beginning of life, one has to learn this Krishna consciousness, and thereby one may become fully Krishna conscious and act accordingly. How does one learn Krishna consciousness so that one can act accordingly, Gadai? From the very beginning of life. That means from the time you're a kid. Lust is only the perverted reflection of the love of God, which is natural for every living entity. Where is this also described in the Bhagavad Gita, this idea of a reflection? Here, Srila Prabhupada is saying, lust is a reflection of the original love for God. Where does it also say that?
Huh?
Yes, 15 chapters, all about that, especially the first few verses, right? Urdva mulamadashakam ashvatam prahuravyayam chandamsi yasya parnani yastam veda savedavet adashchorvam prasritas tasya shaka guna pravrida vishaya pravala adashchamulan anusantatani karma nubhandini manushaloke. So there Krishna is describing how the material world is a banyan tree. It's a perverted reflection where it's an opposite. It's the reflection of the spiritual world. So in a 360-degree circle, it's 180 degrees because the spiritual world's on top. It's reflecting down into the material world. And so all the variety that's there in the spiritual world is there in the material world because it's being reflected here. And what is it being reflected on? What is the water that it's reflected on, actually? desire, actually. Srila Prabhupada said it's desire. So the desire is there. Where is the desire in the material world? Is it in matter? No, it's in the soul. It's in the conscious living entities. They have desires, right? And aparayamitastonyam prakritim vidime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayedam daryate jagat. That's what's maintaining the material universe. The living entities are working hard within this framework of the material energy because of their desires, and they're making it go. That's why it's moving. That's why it's animated. It's animated because we're within it. As soon as we leave the body, what happens to the body? No longer animated. It'll immediately deteriorate and go away. So we're animating everything because we're life, we're consciousness. So now the love in the spiritual world, the love that everyone has for Krishna, when it comes, when it gets reflected in the material world, it's an opposite reflection, it becomes lust. And this is described in the Shastra that khlada trapakari. What's the highest pleasure in the spiritual world becomes the greatest source of suffering in the material world. And Griya Medi, what is the verse? Yeah, find it in the Shloka book. Srila Prahlad Maharaj, 7th chapter. Sukham hitucham kandud yanena karayod eva tukatukam. He describes how this idea of lust in the material world very specifically talks about sex life. Then it becomes the source, dukkha dukkham, of one misery after another one has to endure. So hleda tapakari becomes what's the hladini shakti, or the source of the highest pleasure in the spiritual world, becomes the source of degradation in the reflected form in the material world. The verse is in Maitunari Griyamedi Sukham Hitucham Kandu Yanor Nena Karayorvetu Katukam Trityanti Neha Kripana Bahuduka Bhaja Kanduti Van Manasi Jam Vishaheta Dira. 242 in the Shloka book. 7945. Can you read the verse, please? With the microphone?
Yanmai tunadi grihamedi sukam hitucham kandu yanena karayora iva dukkha dukkam tripyanti neha kripana bahu dukkha bhajaha kandu tivan manasicham vishaheta dhira.
Translation.
Sex life is compared to the rubbing of two hands to relieve an itch. Grihamedi, so-called grihasthas, who have no spiritual knowledge, think that this itching is the greatest platform of happiness, although actually it is a source of distress. The kripanas, the fools who are just the opposite of brahmanas, are not satisfied by repeated sense enjoyment. Those who are dhira, however, who are sober and who tolerate this itching, are not subjected to the sufferings of fools and rascals.
Thank you. When love of God deteriorates into lust, it is very difficult to return to the normal condition. Nonetheless, Krishna consciousness is so powerful that even a late beginner can become a lover of God by following the regulative principles of devotional service. So from any stage of life, or from the time of understanding its urgency, one can begin regulating the senses in Krishna consciousness, devotional service to the Lord, and turn lust into love of Godhead, the highest perfectional stage of human life. So according to this verse, what is the key to destroying the enemy, lust? Yeah, just in general, niyamya, which means to regulate the senses. To regulate the senses. So the senses have to be regulated so that they just don't go anywhere. And in the psychology behind it, there's a detailed description in the Yoga Sutras about what happens when the senses are unregulated. And what happens is this. The mind experiences a kind of, although it's temporary, and although it has a beginning and an end, it gets some kind of impression of happiness from the senses contacting its object. It comes and it goes. It's fleeting. Krishna says, Adyantavanta konteya, nateshu ramate buddha. An intelligent person doesn't take pleasure in this kind of sense gratification because it comes and it goes. It's illusory. Still, it leaves an impression within the mind that there's some happiness there. And then the next time it becomes much more difficult, or that much more difficult, when the mind remembers the stimulation or the pleasure, wants to do it again. This is also known as an addiction. But all kinds of unregulated sense activities in this world become addicting. And then they force us to do them over and over again. Kama dinam katina katita palita durni deshas. And they're described as bad masters. They force us to do things that we don't want to do over and over again. So one has to take a stand. And going the other way, when we actually regulate the senses and we don't take part in those activities, we regulate them and we get a higher taste. Krishna says, Vishaya vinivartante niraharasya dehina rasavarjam rasopyasya param jishva nivartate. When we get a taste for the happiness in the mode of goodness and in transcendence from controlling the senses and experiencing inward pleasure, then we get an impression of that in our mind also, in a memory. And then, so to speak, it's like strengthening a muscle. When you work a certain muscle over and over again, it breaks down a little bit, and then it gets stronger the next time, and it grows, it gets bigger. So as we practice regulating the senses, we'll also become stronger. When we practice sitting down to chant japa every day, even the mind will, it's like an alligator. An alligator, if you grab an alligator, it'll start twisting and turning, and it'll try to wriggle away. So the mind, if you say, we're going to sit down now, it's like, you know, immediately it wants to go somewhere else, do something else. But day after day, if I regulate, if I sit down and I do it, and I perform my yajna, I do my japa, and I control the mind, then gradually the senses come under control. Hare Krishna. So this is what Krishna is recommending here. Niyamya, regulation of the senses. This is the beginning to conquering the lust that's situated, again, in the senses, in the mind, and in the intelligence, through regulating the senses. Okay, so we've talked about what the symptoms of weakness of heart are, and we also talked about how identifying what they are and where they are is important for conquering the enemy. That's how we can move forward. And we've heard that regulating the senses are important. Again, on the side of unregulated senses, Krishna gives a very clear description of what happens when we don't regulate the senses and focus them on Krishna. Krishna says, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto, think of me. But if the senses go anywhere, the mind goes anywhere and thinks of someone else, like Elvis Presley, or any other kind of a sense object, then Krishna describes jayato vishayan pumsam sangas teshu bajayate. Because of contemplating those sense objects, one develops a sangha, or an attachment to them. That attachment develops. And from that attachment, then lust arises, and I want to enjoy them. And then once I enjoy them, I become disappointed, and anger arises. And anger arises, I lose my intelligence. No more buddhi. No more buddhi yoga. I'm no longer hearing from the super soul. I'm no longer able to follow the directions of my spiritual master. I can't follow the shastra because my intelligence is gone. I become a ship without a rudder. This is the result of allowing the senses to go willy-nilly wherever they like. So, talking about some practical points for overcoming weakness of heart. What are those things, like some specific disciplines that fortify, that strengthen us, strengthen the heart, make us strong in spiritual life, determined, dridavrata, that we can maintain a vow. We can maintain a vow. We can follow our plan rather than the plan of the senses.
If we have something positive, in our spiritual life some experience, positive experience, some spiritual emotions.
You experience something positive in your spiritual life. Very nice, yes.
Association with people who are strong.
An association, yes. By association with sense objects, we go towards them, and if we associate with sat, with pure devotees, then we'll attain those qualities too. So attaining higher taste, let's say yours is, and also good association. What are some other things? Yes.
Using a positive to cut down the negative. For example, if you're envious, you feel envious about somebody, think about three good things that you can go and say to them.
This is very practical. For instance, there's offenses against the holy name. One of them's criticizing devotees. Instead of criticizing, Lord Chaitanya said, then glorify them. That's the antidote. Microphone.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
I found this very interesting in this Purushottama Masa, because chapter a day, that means I started reading, and then I started memorizing the shlokas also. As I started memorizing shlokas, every time those shlokas come again and again, I want to, yes, by heart them first, and then my mind goes somewhere else, but I want to read it again, I want to see whether I got it. So that time, I'll be concentrating on the shlokas. Mm. So that way, I think this is a good way of progressing.
It's a very good way of progressing. It's like pouring milk and all the ink goes out. It's the positive thing. The transcendental sine vibration, it replaces. Hare Krishna. It replaces the any of the negative. And actually, when that remembrance comes back into our mind, that's Krishna. It's actually Krishna. It's His mercy. Sarvasya chaham hridi sannivishto mattak smitir gyanam apohanam cha. He's the source of that remembrance. And when we're remembering Him, we're remembering shlokas, then actually it's He who's giving some special mercy because of your contribution to worshiping Him through your intelligence. It's nice. You had a point? Krishna prasadam, and how does that help overcome weakness of heart?
Definitely purifies the heart and gives us the higher test and clears up the fogginess and shows the path to go towards the right direction.
Give me Shastra Praman. It's a shloka. It's a shloka that, I'll give you a hint, it's a shloka that you chant every
Prasade Sarva Dukhana.
Can you do the whole thing? Let's help her out. Prasade sarvadukhanam hani rasyopajayate prasanna chetaso yashu bhuti pariyavatishte. This is a verse from the Bhagavad Gita that we added on to our prasadam seveya prayers because... Did I win something? Now that needs to be done presently. Oh my goodness. Okay. Vaisheshika Prabhu, sorry for the interruption. We have a situation now that needs to be attended to. Presently, as we speak, a truck is delivering mudungas at Nalisha's house, and her garage is now full. Sorry for that. Five large boxes are lying outside looking for a place to put them. My own garage has no more room. Would anyone have spare, or could they be brought to the temple middle unit? Where are the Deepak? Hare Krishna, thank you very much. We just received a shipment of 54 mudungas and a lot of other things. Thank you very much. Deepak, do you have room? And where are the boxes? At Nalisha's? Do they need to be delivered immediately? Are they in a truck ready to come up?
The truck driver is just waiting.
Could we call him and give him directions? Oh, it's lamentable because we don't want to lose the association of Deepak. Oh my God, now this is a disaster. And Acharya Chandra has to go too. All right. Inconvenience regretted, but we have this philosophy that if we flood the whole Western continent with Madungas, that it'll have a piercing effect on Kali Yuga. It's my fault. So we were talking about prasadam, and in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, prasade sarvatukhanam hanir, that when one gets prasad of the Lord, then his dukkha or misery is eradicated. Prasanna chetaso, then the consciousness becomes joyful. Prasanna chetaso yashu buddhi parivatishide, and the buddhi or the intelligence becomes fixed. So this is a result of getting the mercy of the Lord. That verse follows a verse from the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says that one achieves the mercy of the Lord by following the regulative principles of freedom. So again, through this process of following the instructions of the Lord, then one gets prasad. Now, prasad we also, we call the food that we offer to the Lord, and then it's remnants, and then we call this prasad, or special favor, or mercy of the Lord. So I discovered a while back from doing some research that before Srila Prabhupada would honor prasadam, oftentimes he would say this verse, prasade sarvatukhanam anira supajayate. So he added it to the list. So yes, thank you very much. Okay, yes.
Could you please explain that milk example that you used?
If you have a glass of ink, you can pour milk in it continually until all the ink goes out and all that's left is milk. By the force of the incoming fluid, the existing fluid is pushed out. You try it when you go home. Okay, so far what we're talking in the subject matter tonight is weakness of heart and overcoming weakness of heart. So we mentioned satsang or association with advanced devotees. So we get the quality of those we associate with. That's why when Lord Chaitanya was asked what a Vaishnava is, he said, asatsangachar, avaishnavachar. That a Vaishnava is someone who gives up asatsanga, or false association, or what we call bad association, a contaminated association. Where else in the Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say that? That this is a prerequisite for advancing in spiritual life. That one has to give up bad or false sangha. How about chapter 15? Nirmana moha jita sangha dosha adhyatma nitya vrinivritta kama vanverva mukta sukatukha samjarka chantya mura paramavyayam tat. This verse is one of the first five verses of the 15th chapter that Srila Prabhupada has said give the instruction how to become free from weakness of heart, so that weakness of heart can be taken away by nirmana moha. So first of all, Krishna says nirmana. Nirman means becoming free from false prestige. And moha means illusion. Jitta sangha dosha, one who has conquered. Jitta means conquered. Sangha dosha, the fault of bad association, of wrong association. So good association is described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna bhakti janma mulhoi sadhu sangha. Krishna prema janme teho puna mukya anga. The root cause of devotional service to Lord Krishna is association with advanced devotees. Even when one's dormant love for Krishna awakens, association with devotees is still most essential. Please repeat. The root cause of devotional service to Lord Krishna,
the root cause of devotional service to Lord Krishna,
is association
with advanced devotees.
Even when one's dormant love for Krishna awakens,
association with devotees
is still most essential. So having good association is the root cause of devotional service to Lord Krishna. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explains this in detail when he instructs Sanatana Goswami. This appears in the 22nd chapter of the Madhya Lila. And he tells how actually the very awakening of our spiritual life comes from association with devotees. Because we're wandering in the universe in ignorance. When we get association with devotees, even unknowingly, and we do some seva, then we get a jnata sukriti. And that is a kind of a deposit of spiritual wealth that we carry within our heart, and it carries over from one life to the next. When there's enough of accumulation of that sukriti within the heart, ado shraddha tatasa du sangata bhajana kriya, then the shraddha awakens. That means faith, or a sentiment towards devotional service, a feeling that this is a good idea, I should do this. And that comes from association with devotees. When one's faith awakens, ado shraddha tato sadasanga, that means the first impetus of someone who has awakened faith is to associate with devotees. Isn't it? When someone for instance, some people will get a Bhagavad Gita from our distribution. And if they read the book, or if they have an inclination towards it already and they become attracted to it, one of the first things that they'll do is look for an address. How can I get to where these people are? I want to see some of these people for myself. That's the feeling. Someone wants sadhu sangha. Someone will search out good association. And from that good association, we come to bhajana kriya, or the practice of devotional service, the regulated practice of devotional service. And then we begin this process of purification, eliminating the weaknesses of heart and the anartas within the heart, anarta nivritti. And through this unlayering of these modes of material nature, which have covered us from a time immemorial, then our real nature shines forth, and we develop love for Krishna. And we get help from the spiritual side also. Krishna comes to assist us and infuses us with enthusiasm and sends us guide in the form of spiritual master and knowledge from within. So this is one of the primary ways for becoming free of weakness of heart. It's through satsang, or association with devotees. So shall we talk about that for a minute? Your realization about satsang, the effect that it has, or if you want to introduce some shastra, yes.
I would like to take my example that I was behind my Bhakti Shastri homework, but after associating with Malini, Mataji, it's really helping me, and it's a satsang with her that we read together, and it's helping me to get back to my track of the homework.
Personal experience. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada points this out in the Nectar of Instruction in the verse, Dadati Pratigrinati Guhyam Akyati Prichiti Punkte Bojayate Chaiva Shadvidim Pratilakshanam. There are ways of associating with devotees that are described by Rupa Goswami. He says, giving gifts, accepting gifts. Giving prasad, accepting prasad. Revealing one's heart in confidence, hearing confidential revelations from others. Everything okay?
Everything okay.
Are we losing you?
No.
Oh, good. We get everything then. Excellent.
The seats are lost.
Seat's gone, sorry. So there are six ways of associating with devotees that are described by Rupa Goswami. And he calls this priti lakshanam. They're loving exchanges between the devotees. And in his commentary, Srila Prabhupada points out that in any organization, material or spiritual, this is what takes place. In other words, if you decide you want to become a stock trader, what you'll want to do first is get association with other stock traders. So you'll probably join a stock exchange somewhere, like NASDAQ, or you'll go to Wall Street, and you'll associate. You can join a club. If you want to be a speaker, you'll join the National Speakers Association. If you want to be a table tennis player, there's a table tennis organization right down on the peninsula. You can go join that. And you can associate with other table tennis people and become an enthusiast, and then you'll become good at it. So we gravitate towards the people who are performing the activity we want to achieve. And similarly, it's the same in devotional service. By our association, we become infused. Anything more about satsanga and how it overcomes weakness of heart also?
It gives the higher taste of satisfaction and bonding.
You've experienced that?
Yeah.
Okay.
There was a time that I was kind of lost, and I came to one of the kirtan and lecture, and my heart just knew that this is the place and this is the connection.
Mm. Nice. Thank you. Aruni?
If we associate with devotees, maybe more knowledgeable devotees, most probably they experienced some difficulties in their spiritual life, the similar difficulties, and they will share with us their experience. And this way we will know that we actually can overcome these difficulties because somebody could already. So we will get inspired by that, and then these devotees can even show us the way.
That's very profound. And can you give us some shastra that would enhance that? I'm thinking of a verse. Maybe you can pull it out of my mind. I'm thinking of a verse in the Shirish Upanishad that falls around text number 11, mantra 11. It says, vidyam cha yas tadvedo bayam saha, avidyayam ritum tirtva, vidyayam ritum ashnute. Only one who can learn the process of nescience and transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of repeated birth and death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. I'm just looking because you made that such a nice point, and I actually was thinking about that earlier and made it. Here, I wrote this earlier. Vidyam cha yas. You have to see both sides. You cannot see how to use everything in Krishna's service unless you know what it means to not use everything in Krishna's service. If you've experienced, yes. Could somebody look it up in the dictionary, please? We'll give her the exact. Actually, I can look it up here. Nescience, lacking knowledge, ignorant. From the verb nisieri, nay, not, sieri, to know. Not knowing. Okay, so nescience, yeah. And the idea was that you've experienced the state of being. If you've experienced the state of being disconnected from Krishna in His service, then you can appreciate both sides, and also you can see how others are suffering when you appreciate. Krishna speaks about this in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita when he says, "The best kind of yogi is the one who actually has empathy for other living entities in their sojourn in the material world and their suffering and their distress." You were going to make a point.
Maybe around the same lines, Roji, but because I had this observation, association is what is so costly in this world in any field, as you said. Like, for example, MBA, the content of the course, maybe same in San Jose State and Stanford or Kellogg's.
Hmm.
But it costs so much, like $100,000 per semester in Kellogg's, because the association and the environment that you get there is what you pay for.
Wow, what so. A nice example. Bravo. Okay, 50 points for that one. Very nice. Yeah. That's why a moment's association with someone who has that insight and that realization will change our heart. It's very it's the most valuable thing, actually. So satsang, it can help us overcome weakness of heart. Yes. No.
I just wanted to add that we talked about Gyan and Vigyan.
Yes.
And as I understood, Gyan means theoretical knowledge, and Vigyan means realized, personally realized, the same knowledge, but personally realized for myself,
mm-hmm.
for example. And association with devotees can give us this Vigyan. So we read books, we know theoretical knowledge, but then we hear from the person who realized the same things. And through this association, we get to realize ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very important too.
Yeah. Slightly related point. You want to know about Hawaii. So you can talk to someone who just read a book about Hawaii, or you can talk to someone who just got off the plane, still has sand in their shoes, and they smell like the beach. the latter may give you some extra feature, some extra quality, dimension that you don't get just from someone who read the book thinking about Hawaii. So, yes, Satsang.
The point that was just made, I wonder whether what is being pointed out there is the distinction between just having theoretical knowledge on one hand and a complete understanding on the other. The word was used, realization, that somebody may have the knowledge, I'm not the body, but I'm the soul, at a theoretical level, but they are not able to do anything. They still act in the bodily conception. They have heard about it, but it's like that understanding has not occurred, where they say, like, it's like in your bones that you have now completely understood and you are convinced, because it would seem that they would have to come to the position of complete understanding for them to act from it.
Well, that's a good point. Srila Prabhupada said, go ahead.
Yeah, so the term realization that was mentioned can be equated with this complete understanding, which in itself, which is its own action, as opposed to just theoretical knowledge, which is there, but it remains separate. A person is still doing the same things that he's doing, but has not come to the level of understanding to act.
Nice point. And I would say, in a simplified way, we vote with our feet. Someone may say, well, I realized it, but where are you? Did you show up and do it? Understanding means doing. And even if we don't have fully mature knowledge, if we have enough knowledge and conviction to actually engage in the activity, then we'll come to that point. A ripe mango will become a fully ripened mango by engaging in the process. Iha yasya hirer dasye karmana manasa gira nikila api avashtasu jivan muktasu uchite. This verse from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says that if someone is engaged, body, mind, spirit, in the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that person is jivan mukta. He's a liberated person. And they're voting with their feet, their mind, body, words. They may not be fully mature yet, but because they're engaged in the activity under the direction of the spiritual master and of Krishna, Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru, they're following that process. They're also considered to be liberated. I've given this example before, but it's like in the very beginning, when I surrender to Krishna and I enter within the process officially, then I'm on the team. Like somebody takes vows of initiation, it's said by Rupa Goswami, then you have a sadaka deha. You have a practitioner's body. And even though you're not fully realized, you're on the team. You get to wear the uniform. And you may not be on the field playing the game yet, but you're on the bench. But if the team wins the championship, you get a ring too. So getting in the game is... is an important thing. Association, there's no doubt about it, with realized souls is the recommended process for gaining knowledge. Tadvidi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadakshantite jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshina. One should associate with a self-realized person. Now, what is Krishna's prescription and direction for how to associate with a self-realized person? Tadvidi pranipatena, yes. You have to serve and ask. Pranipat means submission. Pranipat and sevaya means service. So how does that make any difference? How come you get more knowledge when you serve somebody and you inquire submissively? Can't you just demand it? You just get it from a book. Or if you go to the person, why don't they just give it to you for free? Why do you have to submit and offer service? What is your realization? Go ahead, Aruni, and then Ansapriya. We'll describe it more, unpack it. How do you get mercy from a person? Give me some personal realization. When somebody comes and serves you and submissively asks you a question.
Can I give an example?
Please.
Not personal. I mean, if a person lives in a house and he's a rich person, and another person comes to him and does something in a house for free. He just comes every day and does something and says, can I do something for you? And this rich person doesn't understand why is he doing this. And he says, maybe I will pay you. Oh, no, I don't want any payment. I just want to do something for you. And then in time, this knowledgeable or rich person gets interest in this person who comes and serves him every day and every day. And then he says, who are you? Tell me about you and what can I do for you? So he has this open heart to give whatever this person wants. And then this person can ask, oh, please help me. I just don't know this. Explain me. And this way, with open heart, when not knowing person has open heart and serves sincerely, then he can hope for mercy from knowledgeable person to open his heart and give this knowledge.
Nice example. Yes.
It's like when one is serving somebody else, that person is going to feel obligated to one who has served him. So if he's a self-realized soul, he will impart that knowledge to one who has come to him. This is the Sishya-Guru relationship, the disciple-Guru relationship, where the disciple, as such, surrenders to the master, and the master would feel obligated because the disciple is serving him.
What is the nature of that obligation? What does that feel like?
Well, the nature of the obligation is in the bond that has developed between the two, whereby which and it is like it's just spontaneous mercy that would flow from that.
Okay.
I would like to add that this obligation doesn't mean like material obligation, that now you own me something because I did for you so many things. You own me something, but we do expect that the person which we're serving to, it will own us something. So like I'm a disciple, I'm serving my Guru Maharaj. If I'm sincere, I'm expecting that he will be sincere to me too. So I wouldn't have to follow, because in this particular text, in commentary, Prabhupada said that one shouldn't be following blindly. I mean, if somebody tells me to do something, I don't have to follow blind, and I don't have to accept anything blind. I have to go through the knowledge. So if I establish this relationship with my Guru Maharaj, and he asks me to do something, what makes me not to be blind, that I'm expecting that he will be sincere to me too. That will, because in some things I cannot really see, right? So Prabhupada is saying that I cannot go do something. We shouldn't follow blind. But something I can see. I have to accept blind that the Krishna exists, right? The spiritual world is has this characteristic which we've got. So I have to accept it blind. But what I am expecting that I wouldn't, nobody going to cheat me because I was sincere. So I'm expecting in return sincerity. Mm-hmm. That's what I feel like somebody would own me this sincerity.
Okay.
I don't know if it's
Hare Krishna.
Right.
You had a point. I just comment about blind faith. This is sort of a phrase that's used by the enemy of spiritualists in a way. Although I understand the context you're using it, but I would propose that there is no such thing as blind faith. That everyone who comes to spiritual life, one way or another, has some vision, has some taste. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. Maybe preliminary, but they have an idea. And we also, because we're spirit souls, and there's an intuitive way that we understand reciprocation as well, and the reciprocation of love. And we can see that. It's an inherent quality of the soul also. It becomes perverted and contaminated in the material world because everyone's on the take. Everyone has some motive for asking. But there are symptoms of that and a longing for that kind of, you know, relationship. Anyway, your point's well taken. Thank you. Next.
I just wanted to say that it creates, by serving the master, we create an attitude to receive the knowledge. And like if we go with a filled pot, we cannot receive anything. So basically there is space for understanding, and that is the humility, that comes from the humility. Because if you don't have that attitude to understand and to receive that knowledge, then we cannot receive it.
That's a really nice point. That's bringing it from the side of from the other side, not from the one who's giving the knowledge, but from one who's trying to accept the knowledge. And Krishna makes the same point in the 13th chapter, where he says, "Amanitvam adamvitvam ahimsa shantirajavam." And he points out that the path of knowledge begins with amanitvam, which means humility. And I like the way you put that you empty yourself out. Otherwise, what can you take? You had a point? Mike here, and then over here.
Prabhuji, my question was that if you are serving somebody with the intention that you're going to get something back, isn't that like a fruitive action and a little selfish act?
Yeah.
So is it okay to do those kind of things?
Well, it depends what you want back.
Okay.
I mean, when Prahlad Maharaj was offered a benediction by Lord Nrisimhadev, he said, "My Lord, I'm not serving you because I wanted a benediction. I'm not a merchant. I'm not. My bhakti is for bhakti's sake only. It's not. I'm serving you for service. I'm not asking anything in return." And Bhagavan Nrisimhadev said, No, I give benedictions. Take something." And he insisted that you take something. And then he asked that you save my father. And he said, "Your father's already saved." Then he said, "If I ask any benediction, I ask that from within the core of my heart there be no material desire." That's something. That's a big deal. But you're asking something. Also, those who approach Krishna, yam krodha kama sahajav pranayadi piti vatsalya moha guru gaurava sevya bhavai. Brahma's pointing out in the Brahma Sanghita that we approach Krishna even with some material desire. Akama sarva kama va moksha kama udharadi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. That even you approach with some motivation, Krishna will purify that. Who's the greatest example of that in the Bhagavatam?
Dhruva
Maharaj. He He just wanted a kingdom bigger than his father's, bigger than Brahma. He wanted something that, wouldn't even be destroyed at the time of the universal destruction. And Narada Muni came to appease him and say, go back. And he said, thanks for the instruction, but I'm going to find God because I want something. And after he was able to connect, when Krishna revealed himself to him, he said, I was searching for broken pieces of glass. Now I have attained the greatest jewel. So he was purified in his desire. So even if one has some motivation, one should still approach Krishna. You had a point. Thank you. You're okay? Okay.
Prabhuji, I also would like to add that a person who serves will, like when you mentioned about emptiness, it's kind of like a person will give up his ego. And that's very important because a person with ego will never serve, or a person with ego will never give.
Give up false ego. Yeah, we always have ego. Ego, yeah. Means our sense of identity.
Yes.
But we replace false it. Ego. We replace the false ego that I am this body with the ego of I am Krishna's servant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our eternal ego.
Prabhuji, my point is like if a person sincerely serves his master, I mean, what I mean to say is like a person should serve his master in a way that he gets pleased. And by that I mean, like already, like mentioned, like with the humility, with the sincerity, giving up the false ego and all, the master gets automatically pleased. I mean, the master gets pleased, and once he is pleased, I think he will automatically impart knowledge to the servant.
It's automatic because it draws. It's out of the force of love and gratitude. I mean, when someone does something for you that's utterly thoughtful. Does that ever happen? Somebody just does something that's completely thoughtful and there's no motivation behind it. How does it make you feel? I know how it makes me feel. Even if it's a small thing or it's a thoughtful thing, I want to pour my heart out to that person. I mean, I want to give them something back. I've immediately become consumed and thinking, what can I do for this person? I can't stop thinking about it. And Krishna has the same proclivity that... you know, he's bhaktavatsal. When the devotees serve him selflessly, he's thinking always how to serve his devotees. Yes, Vanamali. Oh, one more stop, and then go ahead, and then come back.
I hope this is related, but I keep thinking of the sweet story of Sudama Brahmana.
Yes.
And Krishna and the small amount of rice and the sweetness in that relationship and that exchange.
Yeah.
And Krishna's gratitude for such a small morsel even. Of course, he's such a high example of that sweet exchange and that relationship of some kind of service and some kind of gratitude. But I just keep thinking maybe you could say something about that sweet pastime.
And Sudama Brahman was requested by his wife to go visit Krishna. And to ask for something, because she said, you're old friends from Gurukula. And he'll certainly be inclined. He's able to give you anything, and we're living in poverty. And so why don't you go ask? So Sudama Brahman thought, I don't want to ask anything from Krishna, but I would like to see him. I would like to be with Krishna. And before he left the house, his wife gave him some poultry chipped rice, and he tied it in his cloth, and that was all they had. And when he entered into Dwarka to see Krishna, saw all the opulence there, he was overwhelmed seeing all that. And when he saw Krishna, Krishna invited him in, sat him on his own bedstead, washed his feet, began serving him, and treated him as he was, as his most dear friend. And Sudama Brahman, out of love and friendship for Krishna, was simply overwhelmed by this exchange. And when it was time to leave, he had not even thought about giving him this paltry chipped rice. Even if he had, it seemed like such an insignificant thing in the face of all this opulence. But Krishna says, wait a minute, you have something for me. And Sudama Brahman hesitated. He didn't want to give that because he thought this isn't good enough for Krishna. But Krishna was overwhelmed with the love of Sudama Brahman and wanted to have that. So he actually snatched it from him. And he took it once, twice, and then Rukmini checked him the third time and said, no, you can't take three because I'm already so obligated to him now, just from that, that if you give another, I don't know how I can repay him. And Sudama didn't think anything of any kind of reciprocation from the Supreme Personality of God on you know, as far as wealth or tit for tat. He was simply absorbed in love for Krishna, and all the way home he was thinking about his wonderful friend. But when he approached his former residence, which was a little shack, a little hut that they lived in, he saw that the whole area had been transformed. And there were beautiful Gandharvas roaming in the now very lush gardens, and they were singing. And they were all ornamented very beautifully. And his house, that had been a little shack, had turned into a large palace. And there was an elaborate description of all the opulence that was there. And his wife came out, and she had also been transformed and offered her obeisances. And then he saw that by Krishna's special mercy, whatever small thing he had been completely transformed. And he was not affected by that in the least, because his love for Krishna was what was maintaining him. That pastime is also, there's similar in the Chaitanya Bhagavat with Sridhar, who is the, he used to sell the core of the banana tree. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he was very poor. He had a damaged iron pot that he kept outside of his house, his little hut. He was also living in poverty. But he was a perfectly pure devotee and always happy thinking about the Lord. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his Nimai Pandit, still living in Navadvip, used to come and visit regularly. He would even harass him, and he would ask him to give him his goods for a much cheaper price than they were than he was selling them for. And he would, Sridhar would say, why don't you'll go buy them from, so there's so many people selling these things. No, I want yours. Because he was so attracted to Sridhar. And actually, just the night before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had taken sannyas, Sridhar had brought to him a gourd that had grown from his thatched roof. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was thinking, I'm going to take sannyas early in the morning, but I have to eat this gourd because it was brought by my pure devotee. And just then, someone else brought him some milk. So he went to his mother and said, please cook the milk and the gourd together. Give me the preparation. And he wants the love of his devotee, whatever is offered from his pure devotee, he accepts that with great relish. Sunny.
Prabhuji, the Acharya Parambara, when the Shishyas come to the Sannyasi or Acharya, most of the time Sannyasis or Acharya, they are in the meditation. Even they are sitting like that, disciples sit close to them, and that open heart Mataji was mentioning, usually the knowledge, even if both of them are silent, the knowledge will come as a love. Traditionally, when disciples go into the Gurukula, what they learn more than the scriptures, that something from the Guru's nature, attitude, how do Guru do these things, how do they, you know, such a situation, how do Guru handle that things. And there is a lot of things learning from that that relationship is just a silent knowledge.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, your point is that one can learn by observing the example of an exalted person, not necessarily just from seeing the example of someone. That's the
it's
example.
Part of
that's
that.
That's what you're saying. Huh?
As, what I'm saying is that's a, there's a portion of that.
Well, what's the other portion?
Other portion is either way that that love, open heart between guru and shishya need to be happen. Otherwise, the knowledge doesn't come.
Okay, so you're saying that
the very much meaning of that Upanishad is also that, right, Prabhuji?
Yeah, but the inquiry is important. This is that, this is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. Tadvidi pranipatena priprashnena sevaya. The questions should come from the disciple. The service should be there. Should be some activity, and we vote with our feet. We vote with our hands. I'm just a little reluctant to accept a silent communication between guru and spiritual master, between spiritual master and disciple, because it could be misinterpreted. For many years, there have been there are propagation of ideas between guru and disciple that, you know, the guru taps the disciple on the head and there's a transmission, you know, like electricity. There's a practical relationship. You know, like in any relationship, there's a development of trust and there's a development through service and inquiry, and it goes on. Certainly, Upanishad means to sit up close, but the implication of that is that, you know, one's very eager to serve and to be close. Of course, described in Shastra also, one's relationship with the spiritual master is kind of like fire. You don't want to be, if you get too close, you get burned. And if you get too far away, you don't get any heat. So it, there's an art. Like, you know, it's possible. It's a practical thing. I saw some devotees, they in serving Srila Prabhupada, they became, they were close in proximity. They worked with Srila Prabhupada, and they became overly familiar. And it burned them. Actually burned them. They could start finding fault or thinking, well, I'm as good as he is, or, you know, so many other things could come in and contaminate the heart of a disciple. So one has to be very careful in one's relationship. Yasya prasada bhagavat prasado, yasya prasada nagati kutopi. And Krishna himself says, acharyamam vijaniyam, that one should see the acharya to be as good as Krishna and not consider him an ordinary person, because he's a representative of all the demigods. This is verses quoted by Rupa Goswami and Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So there is a very important etiquette between guru and disciple through which the transmission takes place. I don't know any shastra that specifically mentions that just through silent transmission, but I think your point was more towards, like Saint Francis is attributed to have said to his disciples, that you teach all day long, and sometimes you even say something. In other words, example is better than precept. You can say so many things, but if you see, you know, your teacher is doing it that way, that's the way you're going to do it eventually, right?
There is a learning curve like that too, right? I mean,
yeah. Yes, there's a learning curve. Yeah.
Prabhupada, his relationship with this Guru Maharaj.
Yes.
There is, he did, they have a relationship, but there is a deep understanding that what is Guru Maharaj want. And that's what Prabhupada dedicated his life to become.
Yeah, and Prabhupada also said that when he first met his guru, of course, when he first met him, it was a short meeting, but then after that, when he approached him and he began to hear from him, he said he didn't understand everything he was saying. But he kept listening. He liked to hear. He stayed to hear. He sat up close, and he listened, and he listened, and he listened. And Prabhupada pointed this out also, that sometimes Prabhupada would give a lecture in Hindi or Bengali, and his American disciples who didn't understand, they would sit there and listen anyway, and he appreciated very much, because he said the sound vibration. Or even the opposite was true too. Sometimes some people who didn't understand English and Prabhupada was speaking that way, he would admire the fact that they stayed and listened, because the vibration is purifying.
So,
yes, you had a point a long time ago.
Well, it's on the same line. I've been thinking about it the whole time.
it better come out then.
Well, just like you said about this tapping on the head. Thank mm-hmm. you. You know, I was thinking the same thing because you also said not reading a book. Or that, you know, we have to have a spiritual master in order to serve and inquire from. And obviously if you have a book, you can't serve and inquire from. So, or submissively inquire. So the question is then, how is this transmission taking place? Because if it's simply you ask some question and he gives you an answer, the answer is already there in the books that he's written, or the answer may already be there in so many other sadhus. So where is this personal relationship with the spiritual master, who may not even be on the planet anymore? How is it that, how is that transmission actually going on then? Because Prabhupada said it doesn't go like that, and it's through, you know, so how is it? I mean, how is this transmission actually taking place? You know, in other words, you know what, and the transmission of knowledge is what I'm talking mm-hmm. about.
Well, you want to make a point? Okay.
Someone performs service, they're giving their attention and their energy. So by giving your attention and your energy, that means you're naturally becoming more receptive towards the object of your devotion. And through giving your energy and your attention and becoming receptive, you're then able to receive something that you maybe couldn't receive if that loving exchange isn't going on. And also, what I was thinking is the more you serve someone, the more possessiveness you develop towards that, the more minus you feel towards that. So in this material world, minus is not a very good thing, but if the minus or that feeling of mamata, I think, or possessiveness towards something which is, or someone which who can help you starts to grow through that loving reciprocation, then they also feel a sense of that same feeling towards you. So the more you invest in something, the more that thing or that person becomes very personal to you, very related to you.
Thank you.
I don't know if I explained what I was trying to
do. I think you did well. It's nice. Rakshit?
Here you go. Good answer.
Could we say that this transference that is occurring between a guru or a spiritual master and the person who's inquiring involves the transmission of the sound vibration, the process of hearing and listening, which may not necessarily be occurring when one opens a book? So I may open a book and I may look at Shastra and read it, and then I hear a self-realized soul speaking to me when I'm inquiring, that there is a difference there, that sound vibration is coming. And a lot has been said about the process of hearing, that hearing is a process when somebody listens sincerely, that sound vibration can penetrate the heart and cause purification and all kinds of things. Shastra also says that when a devotee listens to self-realized souls speaking the Bhagavatam, Krishna himself enters the heart and clears away all the dust of material contamination. There is something to be said about sound vibration coming from the guru mm-hmm. and the process of hearing and listening that's going on, which may not be happening with a book.
There's a very practical aspect to this. There's book Bhagavata and there's the person Bhagavata. And both are important. And however, they're slightly different. We could say that like the book is passive in a way. And this is partly what you're saying. Book is passive and it's there. We can go and read it. We can follow or not follow. And the guru or the person Bhagavat is more of an active agent in our life, that person can actually come after us and say, no, do it like this, do it like that. There's an active relationship. There is something mysterious and intangible about our personal relationships, because actually the soul is amazing, consciousness is amazing. But it is undeniable, and we find it in every aspect of life and in learning. For instance, with musicians, people will become attached to a certain musician, and they'll listen to their music on CDs and tapes. But when the musician comes to town, it's a bonus, actually, to go there and see the musician. You could just say, well, why don't you just listen to him on tape? It's the same thing, right? It's the same vibration. No, it's not. There's something intangible when you actually go and you're present there, and you go to the concert. And then if you get a front row seat, it's even better. Because you can see, and you're like, wow, I saw his boots, and I could see this, the spray coming from his mouth while he was singing, and there are extra elements. Then if you get invited backstage and you get to know the person, in every aspect of life, someone brought this up earlier too, the books may be the same, but if someone goes to an MBA program where the teacher actually has deep realization of the books, there's a lot of information in the books, but if someone's realized the knowledge and can bring it out in a unique way, that'll make all the difference in the world. There's a purport in the 75th verse in the 18th chapter where Prabhupada says on page 759, the spiritual master is the transparent medium. Although it is true that the experience is still direct, this is the mystery of the disciple succession. When the spiritual master is bona fide, then one can hear Bhagavad Gita directly as Arjuna heard it. Did you hear that or did you miss it, Dainiti? There's a lot of traffic. Dainiti, a lot of traffic coming through.
Yeah, I didn't hear
this just goes to the mystery of this personality. That the spiritual master is a transparent medium, although it is true that the experience is still direct. This is the mystery of the disciplic succession. I want to make a couple more points about this weakness of heart before we finish up, because we talked for a little while about satsang and how that has an effect on us and how it helps us overcome weakness of heart. And I also wanted to mention that about inspirational sadhana, that our practice every day, everything comes back to our chanting. When we chant with full attention and we call out to Krishna and we pray to Krishna when we're chanting his name and we connect to Krishna through his holy names and we actually have an experience, then we feel automatic detachment and knowledge. Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita Janaya Yashu Vairagyam Jnanam Chayara Haitukam. These are byproducts. Jnana and Vairagya are byproducts of this connecting to Krishna through the chanting of his holy names. If we don't have knowledge, we don't know what to do. And if we don't have Vairagya, we can't do it even if we know it. So we need Jnana and Vairagya. Jnana Vairagya Yuktayam. Verse? What am I thinking of? First canto, second chapter. Pashyantyatmanyavastitam. No, that's not it. Anyway, it's probably not in the shloka book. It's in the first canto. Can somebody grab me a first canto, please? So, this is another very important aspect of overcoming weakness of heart, is that we have to regulate the senses and we also have to get inspiration from our sadhana every day. A direct experience for ourself. Hare Krishna. Tachtradhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya pashyantyatmani chatmanam bhakta shuta grihitaya. This verse says we must be fortified by this jnana and vairagya in order to have firm footing in devotional service. So that comes through inspirational sadhana. We have to experience it for ourselves on a daily basis when we're chanting. Also, there's a...
That
verse is number 12. 1, 2, 12. And one other practical thing is the cultivation of gratitude. How does gratitude overcome weakness of heart? Any thoughts? Yes.
We have this weakness
of heart. Oh, we can't hear a word unless there's a microphone.
One of the weaknesses of heart was envy.
Yes.
And if we are grateful to someone, we will not envy this person. So if we can find some gratitude in our heart towards any every personality, we will not envy.
Thank you. Thank you. Another point?
Gratitude actually kind of, in my point, it puts me into the sense of that I am not the doer, and it gives me the sense of the servantness, and it kind of helps to give up the false ego and opens up to see the real maintainer and the provider of the soul.
Okay, that's a good point. And Prabhupada mentions this in the verse Rasohamapsukonteya, when he speaks about how the devotee, Krishna says, I'm the taste in water. And there's a quenching feature. Water can quench our thirst. There's nothing quite like it, actually. And he mentions in his purport how the impersonalist sees it as an energy. And the personalist actually appreciates it, that it's Krishna's special mercy, that Krishna's quenching his thirst, and that the water is Krishna. So he makes a connection through gratitude with Krishna that he's given this water that's quenching his thirst. And this is a way, actually, it's the very beginning stage. I mean, most mothers teach their children when somebody gives them something, it says, say thank you. In the beginning, it's something that's taught to children. Say, okay, say thank you. They gave you something, say thank you. And then later on, when someone becomes mature, they actually develop their own sense of gratitude, that when someone gives them something, they appreciate. It's a mature attitude, actually. And when a devotee matures in devotional service, he or she experiences gratitude in the extreme, so much so that Tatenu kampam susamikshamanu bunjana evatmakritam vipakam. The devotee is feeling that even when horrific things happen in his or her life, that they're feeling gratitude. Thank you, Krishna. You woke me up. I needed a slap on the face, to wake up and really take this process seriously. Now I can see you again. That's how much gratitude the devotees have. They live in gratitude. They're never disconnected from Krishna. And this, the opposite of that, the ingrate, when something bad happens, they blame God. People do this all the time. There's an earthquake or something, say, there's probably no God, and if there is, why is he so bad? He's killing everybody, And if something good happens, they think, what do we need God for? We're so smart. We have science. And God's irrelevant. He's dead. This is a disconnection from the Supreme. And it's actually the grossest illusion. But gratitude connects us. The gratitude for everything that we have and realizing that it's coming from Krishna, the good or the bad. And once we have that, then that weakness of heart to withstand whatever we have to do in this material world becomes augmented and strengthened. And there was one other thing that I wrote down, and that is that there are adjustments we can make every day, practical adjustments we can make in our life. Not huge, major renunciation. Necessarily, but voluntary life changes. Voluntary life changes that anyone can make in their life. Give us strength and heart. When I say voluntary, I've told the story before, but Giriraj Maharaj had passed on this story about when Srila Prabhupada was being visited by a young man who was helping translate the books into Marathi in Bombay. And his father, the father of this young man, would also come and visit sometimes. And he was addicted to smoking. And so he had asked Prabhupada several times, or he had mentioned that he wanted to give up smoking, and then Prabhupada asked him about it. And he said that, "I need your special mercy, your special blessings." And Prabhupada had said, "You can get the special blessings, but it means that Krishna will make you so miserable that you'll be forced to give it up." Or he said, "You can voluntarily do it. Decide on yourself." So what I've suggested for overcoming weakness of heart, a practical thing, is to make voluntary life changes that you can do right now. What you have a certain qualification, but do it. Don't be lazy. Make the voluntary life changes that you can make. Make them now. Make them voluntarily, and you'll move ahead. And if you find out what those things are, like someone had suggested... a long time ago, I had heard one of these suggestions. This is even passed on in secular circles as a way to become more peaceful, as a media fast. You know what a media fast is? Like, don't listen to the news because it just agitates the mind. Try it. I haven't listened to the news in years. I have a theory about this. I don't look at newspaper. I don't listen to the radio. I don't TV, nothing. Even when I travel, I see everyone. They're getting on the plane, and especially on international flights, they're all picking up a paper, and I just don't look at it because I think Super Soul revealed this to me a long time ago. But it's this idea that whatever news actually breaks the threshold of being actually important, I'll hear it on the street, and if it doesn't reach that threshold, I don't need to know about it. If it's that important, someone's going to tell me, walking down the street, they'll say, "Hey, did you hear what? They just blew New York up, or something like that." I'm like, "Oh, okay, I'll hear about it." I don't have to go into the minute details and learn every single detail about it. So you can fast from the media and see how it changed your life. Voluntarily do it. There's so many different things that you can do now that'll give you some extra standing or even extra time to do sadhana. And less agitation of your mind. So figure out what your voluntary life changes are, VLCs. and concentrate on your VLCs, Hansapriya.
I also like the point you made on your Sunday morning class and Sunday evening class about being satisfied with what you have.
Yes. Practice satisfaction. It's an internal exercise to be satisfied. It's not external. It's not that when the world becomes adjusted, because it never will. That's Krishna's guarantee in the Bhagavad Gita. You'll never find a place on this planet or in this universe. Abrahma bhuvana loka punar avartino arjuna mamupeti tukonteya punar janma nivitite. You won't find a place anywhere here where the external environment will adjust to your needs. Just face it right now. But if you adjust your internal needs to be... minimal or non-existent to the external environment, then you'll be satisfied. And there was a great study done about relationships and marriage. I heard this recently about how some sociologists had poured millions of dollars into a research project to find out how people could be happier in marriage, and they came up with one prime directive. Lower your expectations. And that works everywhere you go, across the board. Just lower your expectations, and you'll be happy. So just as a review, yes.
Prabhuji, does gratitude somehow lead to satisfaction?
Pardon me?
Does gratitude lead to satisfaction?
Absolutely. Have you ever noticed that when you have gratitude, you're happy no matter where you are?
Just what you have.
And if you don't have gratitude, it doesn't matter where you are. And it doesn't matter what anybody gives you. They can give you everything. They give you the three worlds. And that's what Vamanadeva said. That when Bali Maharaj said, three paces of land, why don't you take, like, you know, a planet or something? And Vamana said, if I'm not satisfied with three paces of land, if you give me three planets, I won't be satisfied. So, yes, definitely. Practicing satisfaction and cultivating gratitude. Cultivate gratitude. This helps to overcome weakness of heart. And we also mentioned satsang. Get good association. When you can get good association, then you'll feel satisfied. There's such a satisfaction being with a sadhu, because sadhus are satisfied. And if you're with somebody who's satisfied, it also permeates, it emanates. Yes, Sukeshwari. Is that Gaur Krishna?
Yeah.
He sounds pretty satisfied.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
Prabhu, I was thinking for satisfaction. So this is satisfaction for whatever we get materially, right?
Yes.
But we can always be unsatisfied with what we get spiritually.
Well, it's simultaneous. With spiritual attainment, it's a mysterious way in which we're satisfied, but we're hankering for more at the same time. Unlike material satisfaction, it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. There's a second where the satisfaction seems to be there, and then it increases even more in a pernicious way.
That's right. So I was thinking for a devotee, maybe a person who's been in Krishna consciousness for long, or a new person, if they want to continue their higher studies, which may not be related to Krishna consciousness, do you think that is okay? Or the person should be just satisfied?
It depends why they're continuing their higher studies. And everything depends on why you're doing it. So any decisions you make in your life, if they're based on how you can increase your devotional service, then you'll always do the right thing. This is how to do the right thing. I'll just tell you right now. If you make any decisions in life, which you will have to do regularly, based on how it will improve your devotional service, then you'll never make a mistake in making a decision. And so whether it's higher education or making more money or where you're going to live, if you base it on how to be closer to Krishna and how to improve your devotional service, then it's a good decision.
So if it's a higher education which is related to Krishna consciousness, then it's okay, but if it's not?
Anything that's related to Krishna is okay. And anything that's not is called maya. And that's what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Ritertam yat pratiyeta na pratiyeta chatmani. Tadvidyara manomayam yatapaso yatatamaha. This is part of the Chatur Shloki, the original Srimad Bhagavatam, four shlokas. And he says that ritertam yat pratiyeta, anything that is disconnected from me is my illusory energy. Be careful. Because it's detrimental to the soul. It won't help you. It's illusory. So we have to see the connection behind everything. We have to make the connection in everything that's connected, like karma. Karma means work. And if you connect the karma to Krishna, what does it become? It becomes karma yoga.
Karma yoga.
And if you have knowledge, just knowledge, and you connect it to Krishna, what does it become?
Jnana
yoga. So you know a thing's value is Prabhupada used to say about the Americans, you know, he'd say you have so much material facility. As it looked a lot more like that previously too, 1970s and 60s, because America was so far ahead materially. But he would say you have many, many zeros, and now you have to put a one. When you put the one in front of the zeros, then it becomes a big number. So he said, all of you, you have so many zeros. Because there's so much material advancement and education. Americans have all these things, but then you don't have Krishna. So if you put Krishna in front, then it becomes valuable. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. So now we're going to have, after Deepak makes his
point. I wanted to
discuss microphone? Granted, you may not need one, but.
Prabhu, so we said lust is the weakness of the mind. And I wanted to ask, what's the role of a greed in the weakness of the, weakness of the heart. What's the role of a greed in the weakness of the heart? And how they are different, lust and greed. Is it just sexual desire, lust, and material gains, greed?
Well, Krishna describes lust as sort of the overarching, you know, sentiment that's the major enemy of the living entity, and other kinds of sentiments as well, like greed, are subsumed under that category of lust as well. In the Hari Nam Chintamani, Bhaktivinoda Thakur speaking through Haridas Thakur, speaking of him describing these weaknesses of heart, talks about all of these anartas, like lust and greed, come from originally from ignorance. This is one of the major points that Thakur Haridas makes. They all arise from ignorance. So originally, we are Krishna conscious living entities. However, now due to the covering of mist and fog, just like the sun is forever luminous, but for some people who are in an area where there's fog or mist, they can't see the sun, and they can't take advantage of the sun rays. So similarly, Krishna is there always, but when I become covered by cloud or mist, then I can't take advantage of the sun. I can't see the sun. So what creates the cloud and mist is ignorance. Ignorance. And what is ignorance? Ignorance means ignorance. It means ignoring Krishna. That is my primary defect. And this is the root cause of all the other difficulties that I have. It's ignorance. I've turned away from Krishna. Bhayam dvitiya abhinibesha tasyat ishat api tasya viparyayo smritihi. I've become a reversed condition. I've turned my face away from Krishna, and it's the most painful condition, and it creates bhayam or fear. And you can experience this. If you ignore someone, if you ignore another conscious living entity, it's very painful exercise, actually. And being ignored is also painful. So Krishna consciousness means to eradicate ignorance at its source by turning one's attention back to Krishna, to our original source. And then the clouds and mist, they become dissipated. And all types of anartas, lust, anger, greed, and all those things become dried up by the power of the sun of Krishna's holy name. Last point.
Do we have time for another question? Actually, one supplement to what Mataji asked. If we look around and we see the professions that we practice and the education that we pursue, we can't relate, we can't directly find any evidence that they can be really, really dovetailed, or, very easily they can be forked into devotional service. So how do you do that? How do we connect? Is it possible that we can connect, or we have to just abandon whatever we are doing and follow something that can be dovetailed?
We're always connected to Krishna, and we can always find a way to connect to what we're doing. The question really is, how to make advancement. And the answer is generally by acting properly in the situation you're in now. Sve sve adhikarya nishta saguna parikirtita. Krishna tells Uddhava in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam that according to your qualification, your adhikari, everyone has some qualification at this particular point. Sve sve adhikarya nishta sagunan parikirtita. If you act according to what you can do now, that's a good quality. And if you try to do more than you're qualified for doing now, Krishna says that's a bad quality. It's the opposite. What's beautiful, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, is when someone understands their qualification and they act according to that, because then you'll gradually make advancement. And in the Bhagavad Gita 12th chapter, Krishna gives a progression of ways that you can stay connected to him. First, he says, if you always think of me 24 hours a day, ananya bhakti, just stay absorbed in love for me. If you can't do that, he said, then practice the rules and regulations of devotional service so that you can come to that point. If you can't do that, he said, then give some of the fruits of your work to help spread Krishna consciousness. We talked about this on Sunday. Someone had mentioned that if you give your money, if you're attached to money, if you're working, and Prahlad Maharaj says this, everyone's attached to money. He says, money is the honey. And everyone's mind is attached to making money. So if you give your money away to Krishna, if it goes in the hundi, then all night long, your mind will be right in the hundi, right at Krishna's lotus feet. So your mind will follow your money. So you give away some of the fruit of your work. Whatever work you're doing, give it away to Krishna. If he said, if you can't do that, then just be charitable. If you can't be charitable, he said, because charity, it begins the giving process, because devotional service is the ultimate giving. It's giving, when we offer grains into the fire, we say swaha. Actually, what you're supposed to offer the fire is yourself. We just offer a little grain. We just like, okay, here, take this. You're supposed to actually jump into the fire and be consumed in the fire of devotional service. We get, okay, swaha. I'm saying swaha, I'm giving myself. But we give a little bit. But we start somewhere. Start the giving process, Krishna says. And if you can't do that, then he gives a whole progression. Then you can do meditation or renounce the fruits of your work, because that will lead to knowledge. So there's a long progression. Everyone can start somewhere in the process. And no one's excluded from that. In any position, one can begin according to their qualification and then move up. It just takes a little bit of adjustment. Do what you can with what you have, and then you'll get more. Krishna will quickly come in and give you more opportunity from that position. Om Tat Sat. Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Overcoming weakness of heart ki jai. Prabhupada once said, just saying jai, it actually gives you strength. So I remember he said that in San Francisco, and after that, when we'd say the Prema Dwani prayers, everyone would scream it out and say, you know, Bhaktivinoda Swami ki jai! You know, just that victory. All glories to the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanande Hari Hari Bol. So now let's put away all the books, the Shastra deities who have descended in this world for our benefit and guidance very carefully up in their shelf, and all the asanas, and we'll have our...